listener production.
Just as the traffic light went orange, he kind of slammed the brakes on really hard. I was way too close to him. I stopped. But what stopped me was the back of his bumper, basically. That car was a complete write-off.
It's a topic that might sound very simple, but in fact carries a lot of weight, following distance and perhaps even a bit of peer pressure around that. That is the subject matter of today's show. Hi, everybody. I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
Welcome to Keep Your Wheels On, the podcast where you'll hear from real people talking about the mistakes that either resulted in them crashing their car or even narrowly avoiding a situation that could have perhaps been much worse. And along the way, we're going to be joined by experts to chat about how you can do your best to avoid ending up in a similar situation. Our expert guest today is James Stewart from Driving Solutions, a company that's been doing this training I'm talking about in all sorts of areas for the past 25 years. They cover 500 events each year, everything from the Australian Tennis Open and ensuring that their drivers are equipped as best they can be when they ferry that very special cargo, those tennis champions around Melbourne, to those that are starting out and want to be better on our roads. James, welcome to you.
Thank you. Lovely introduction.
The whole notion of this, right, following distance, how important is that in what you tell all of these people that you instruct?
Well, I think it's basically comes up to a third of all accidents are people travelling too close to each other. So the courtesy on our roads is where it all starts from, and having that safe travelling distance is probably the biggest start to avoid a crash on the roads. And I find that we always in a hurry, so we close that gap up, and that's where I think it all goes wrong.
But it doesn't actually get you there any quicker.
Oh, let's go there. Like anyone who can do the maths, you know, if you leave a 3-second gap and someone pushes in front of you, if 60 people push in front of you in an hour, that's an extra 3 minutes to get to your destination. And sadly, who can't afford that?
Lise, can we expand the conversation a little bit here and come to you? Because you often work with young people, right? What about the peer pressure element of this?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure why this is happening. Even my son, I mean, you know, we taught our son very well, but still I get in the car with him and he still wants to sit too close to the person in front.
And that's the whole thing. I think we do think that we can make up time when we drive. And I think the biggest thing is every time that we try and rush it, we sit close to the car in front, it just takes longer. So it's trying to put those old heads on young shoulders to allow that space.
Not to mention the anxiety levels.
Well, the brake pedal on the passenger's floor goes really hard a lot.
We all lead busy lives. Some of this is a bit of bravado, but one of the really important things we're going to discuss today is around safe distances, knowing the kind of markers you need to give yourself time to pull up if something suddenly changes. Now, the story you heard at the start is someone who did make the mistake of following too close. You can gather that already, and it's had consequences. So let's meet the person behind this story and find out a bit more about what happened.
Hi, I'm Scott. When I was 17, I was following a mate's car too closely, crashed, wrote his car off, and also almost wrote my parents' car off as well. Well, I got behind the wheel as soon as I could, legally. So I got my L's, 16, and then got my P's, I believe at 17. I would categorize myself as an anxious person. As far as driving goes, I certainly was quite nervous. My dad taught me to drive, and I think I took just a handful of classes as well. It was a long time ago, so it was before you needed to do like a 1,000 hours of driving practice in a little booklet. And that was an interesting experience, but I remember just driving around the northern beaches of Sydney in the absolute quietest possible spot, which was often just a quiet car park near a beach somewhere. And I was very nervous. When I was driving with Dad in the early days, it was always with our family car, which was a blue Hyundai Excel, which used to always creak when we would turn any corner. The first time I bought a car was actually not that long ago. So I was already a grown man at that point. And it was partly, I think, PTSD for my early days of driving that I kind of put off having my own vehicle. Yeah, so for a big chunk of my life, I was not behind the wheel at all. I would borrow my parents' car sometimes when I needed it, and that was pretty much it. Outside of that, the occasional drive here and there, I was getting public transport everywhere. I think I was quite a safe driver for the most part. with the exception of being, you know, in high school, that might have been slightly different because we were driving quite late at night, you know, a whole bunch of guys just not really doing anything crazy, going to Macca's, for example, and going to the drive-thru or just parking there and eating some chicken nuggets and then going to the movies, going to people's homes. Outside of that, I think when there's less ego involved and you don't have to keep up with your mates, I was quite a safe driver. I think peer pressure definitely comes into this. Like with anything in life, you know, I think when, especially when you're younger, you know, there's more ego involved. You want to look cool in the eyes of your mates and your friends. You don't want to seem like a wuss. And if they're going fast, you kind of want to keep up with them. And sometimes it's not even going over the speed limit. It's just being slightly reckless at times, accelerating too fast off the from a traffic light, you know, trying to drag race or whatever. So yeah, for sure, I think peer pressure comes into it.
So lots of elements in this one, from perhaps overconfidence to ego to just not coming back to some base principles around safe distances. So, James, can we unpack a little bit of this, right? So Scott talks about, you know, looking cool and how much does that and peer pressure come into these style of accidents, do you think?
Look, it's probably hard for me to answer that because I've never looked cool in my life. So I think it is important to be, you know, fit in with your friends and not be left behind. So I think, you know, back in my days, it was doing laps of the main street with the stereo up and sort of rocking the place. So now we're sort of doing more and more driving. Cars are a lot easier to get to speed. So we become a lot more complacent, I guess, with the newer technology in the car. So it becomes easier for a driver to drive. So you're not thinking so much. So I think the complacency is the biggest bit of being cool in the car because you can just now drive the car so much easier.
Also, he commented about actually regular driving. I mean, when you haven't been driving for quite some time and you know, and there's large gaps in between getting in and out of cars, as Scott had, that would also be a contributing issue, I would think.
Oh, without a doubt. And by the sounds of it, he's driving a car that does sound like pre-ABS as well.
Yeah.
So even understanding the technology of stopping if you're not doing it regularly enough. So there's a lot of understanding and keeping match fit as such, just driving.
So what is the kind of distance, the safe distance you would instruct people to kind of work towards? What sort of parameters do you teach them? And why is this distance restriction, if you like, in effect? Why is it so important?
So I know this isn't the government correct answer to the question, but if someone turned up today to do a driver training course, I would like them to leave with a bigger gap than what they came with. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, we want to try and push that 3-second rule as a guideline, but most people out there are under a second gap between the cars, which is really scary when you consider it. So as long as nothing goes wrong in front of them, they're fine. But the moment something does go wrong.
Just explain that. When you say 1 second, your car would travel 1 second to reach where the car in front would be at that time. Is that what you're saying in terms of judging the gap, if you will?
Yeah, so it's basically if you're going past telegraph poles, signs, marking on the road, just going 1001, 1002, 1003. So when the car in front goes past it, having that 3-second gap before you reach it is the nice, simple way of looking at it.
What would you estimate that would be in metres? Obviously, depending on speed.
Yep, depending on speed. And that's the big thing, that it doesn't matter what speed you're doing, because at 40Ks, it's a lot closer. At 110, it's a lot further. But it's not about the distance. It's about the reaction time. So most people in an unplanned situation take over a second to react. So when they're sitting at a second, you look at the tail enders on the motorways, that by the third or fourth car that involves in the accident, they haven't even touched the brake pedal. So it's that reaction time that we're trying to build in by having a bigger gap. And I guess the big thing is trying to change that gap depending on what the day is. If it's wet, if you're tired, yeah, fatigue, having that bit more.
We've got an emergency braking exercise in drive school. I was actually demonstrating the program to some politicians and I got him to do this emergency braking exercise and the stop signs come out. So you're supposed to like absolutely jam on the brakes. Waiting. It would have been like 3 seconds before. I was like, oh, please remind me never, ever to get in a car with you. I just couldn't believe his reaction time. Nothing.
Yep.
Two things come to mind there, Lisa. Right. Firstly, James, how important is it for the adults who are training the kids quite often, mums and dads and so on, to have that refresher around safe distances. And then from a following distance perspective, you've talked about speed already. Let's throw in another variable. What about a change of weather or driving conditions, different road surfaces and so on?
Yeah, look, I think the big thing is a lot of young drivers already do what their parents do. So it's not like the parents reinforce and say, have a bigger gap. It's about their parents having a bigger gap when they're driving. And I think that's where monkey see, monkey do.
Do it by example is what you're saying, yeah?
And I think that's the biggest thing. Like, we got to change the attitudes that are ingrained in people from years gone by. So I think that's the biggest thing, is it's not just the young kids, it's the parents and their grandparents changing their attitude. But also, as soon as it does rain, the car's not going to stop as well, so give yourself more space. And that gap is there for you. It's not for anyone else. That's for you to be able to stop the vehicle. And I can pretty well guarantee if you're not on the phone, you're paying attention, 3-second gap, you'll never hit the car in front of you.
And you're always at fault if you hit the person in front of you.
Yep. And like we all inspire, especially with young drivers driving on the road, so you'll see them chopping and changing lanes and things like this, and they don't get any further. So it's that relax and not going to the peer group pressure of trying to keep up with other people and, you know, just having that safe gap.
Mm. Mythbusters did timing for people that cut in and out of all the traffic or just stayed in one lane and did it. And there was no difference.
Yep.
So you sort of go, all that anxiety and stress and
for no gain.
You put yourself in all these situations every time you change lanes.
Yeah. And normally you might get to the next set of traffic lights first, but that's as far as you get on Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane roads. It's only getting to the pole position.
Just a couple more points here before we move on with Scott's story. I mean, firstly, everyone's been in a situation where you're following someone who's going a bit slow, right? You still don't want to be too close to them in case something goes wrong. And some people get wound up, James, and kind of want to tap the brake and send a message to those that are following too closely behind. I think in motor racing terms, they call it brake testing. Please don't do that, folks. That is highly dangerous, right? Just explain to people why that is not a good idea.
Not everyone on the roads is experienced. And like, yeah, people play to stand out. But sometimes, you know, when we talk about speed limits, they put a circle around it. So that means you don't have to be doing 70 Ks in a 60 zone, but you also don't have to be doing 55 Ks in a 60 zone. So sometimes people are on their limitations or their fear factor at a lot lower speed. So by you sitting nice and close to them doesn't help the situation as well. So sometimes it's about taking a breath and just getting there when there's a chance to overtake, you know, or basically staying left. And I think probably, Rusty, it goes back to so much attitude out there.
And that's a really good point as we move on here, right? If you are that person who is feeling the pressure because of someone with a bad attitude behind you, pull over, let them by. Don't be daunted by that. Make a good choice. Now, Scott did find himself in a situation where, you know, that following distance saw him come undone, right? So let's find out more about what happened.
When I had my crash, and this is actually the only crash I've ever had, I was 17. It was probably roughly 9:30, 10 p.m. I believe we watched a movie at Warringah Mall on the Northern Beaches. After that, we were actually going to Macca's, funnily enough, which I think a lot of guys were doing when, you know, around 17, 18 at that point as well. So I believe there were about 4 or 5 cars of mates, and we were just driving around. So we were driving to Macca's, went down this hill. And I think there were about 3 people in my car. So me and 2 mates. I was, I think, 3rd or actually last in this line of cars of our mates driving. So the guy in front of me was in a really old Subaru. The traffic light went orange. And just as the traffic light went orange, he kind of slammed the brakes on really hard. I was way too close to him to actually stop in time. He stopped. I stopped. But what stopped me was the back of his bumper, basically. I wasn't speeding, so I was going at the speed limit, so 60 Ks an hour. I would say I was probably closer than I should have been. Yeah, I should have been slightly further away. And he probably slammed the brakes on probably harder than he needed to, but it's my fault for being behind him, obviously. It happened very quickly. very unexpected as well. I feel like when you're younger too, you feel invincible because it hasn't happened to you. But it happened very quickly. You know, it went from everything being fine on the way to Macca's, and then suddenly there's an accident, there's shock. You want to make sure people aren't hurt. So it can be quite traumatising.
This kind of gave him, by the sounds of it, a almost, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder impact on his life and how long it took him before he bought his own car and so on. James, is it fair to say all of us have probably been in this situation? I reckon I can recall one when I was 18, almost out the front of school, and thankfully it only bent the P-plate holder at the time. But it was a massive wake-up call for me because you are then very aware of how hard it is to pull up something so heavy in a short space of time.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think having that experience when you got away with it is a great eye-opener. Mm. But I think one of the other things that we lose a lot and we spend a lot of time in our courses talking about is one of his biggest problems there. He could be used to driving that car Monday to Friday with only him in it. Add three mates, there's another 200 kilos. That car will not stop as efficiently. Mm. So remembering that as you add weight to a car, it doesn't stop as well. So that can also come into play about that misjudgment.
Statistically speaking, also with three passengers in the car, there's something like 150% more likely to have an incident.
And if you think about it, four cars going to Macca's, you do not want to be the last one there.
How common are these type of incidents? And in your opinion, how much of a factor is peer pressure, particularly when it's younger people and it's this style of scenario?
I think it comes back to that whole thing of understanding. So there's a lot of young drivers that we're really trying to drum into them now, how dangerous driving a motor vehicle is. So I think it's getting better, but it's not covering it all, because I think that, like you touched on before, we're all lucky to be here today. I think that we've all done dumb things in our life, whether it's horses, push bikes, jumping off rocks, we've all had experiences. But until we experience something like this on the roads, we don't realise how vulnerable we actually are.
He's actually really lucky. He might have a bit of PTSD because, you know, sometimes that first accident will be your last.
Yep, without a doubt. And that's the really scary thing, that you don't get a second chance. Mm.
Can we talk reaction time with you, James, if you don't mind, and maybe just explain that to people who aren't necessarily familiar with that term?
Yeah, I always like two parts of it. A reaction time is basically measured at school when someone drops a ruler and you try and re-catch it, which is not real, because on the roads, we don't get someone telling us, we get to test your reaction time at the next set of traffic lights. Mm. So I always sort of try and play the game when you're driving to keep aware is, can I actually brake before the car in front of me does, because I can see three cars ahead of them or what's going to make them stop. So by driving ahead of the car in front of you, that's the way you can sort of measure reaction time to see how bad they're not paying attention to three or four cars ahead. So I think driving is a game that we've got to play and take seriously of how can we always do a better job. Your reaction time deteriorates as age. It deteriorates with fatigue. It deteriorates what you've done the night before.
Can I just pick up on something you said there? You've talked about driving to the car in the traffic queue, maybe two or three further up the road. And that raises the whole notion of vision and keeping your head up and looking down the road, not being perhaps fixated on the car directly in front of you. Is that another good takeaway from people in this?
Oh, without a doubt, because vision is the be-all to end-all with driving. If you're looking ahead, looking through the corner, you got to have the most amount of time, the most time to react, and you can see up the road.
Give yourself a whole lot better chance if you're looking 100 metres plus ahead rather than you're looking at just that car here.
And without doubt, and that's where the speed comes into it, especially on country roads. Like the amount of times that people just sit there at 100 kilometres an hour and think it's easy, it's a straight bit of road. But that's when they say the animal came out of nowhere. So vision is so important to everything to do with reaction time.
And also on those country roads, I mean, that's a really good point. And with your speed point, just because it says 70 or 100, it doesn't mean you actually have to drive 100.
Yep.
And a lot of those country roads, the shoulders are so poor, animals, wildlife, all sorts of things.
Yep.
Most of the time I wouldn't be driving at those speeds. Yep. on a lot of those roads.
Can we come to, I mean, something that is a reoccurring theme in different ways here on the Keep Your Wheels On podcast, right? And that is driver distraction. How much of a factor is that in affecting perhaps a good or a safe following distance? And what sort of strategy should people be employing to ensure that fundamentally they're doing that right?
Yeah, distractions come in so many shapes and forms. And the more technology that gets added, the more it comes real. Like, I've only ever been involved in one accident on the public roads, and that's where I've been turning right and a P-plater behind me is on the phone and just drove straight over the top of me. So I think the distractions with traveling with a safe distance is null and void, because you can only see the distance if you're looking up. You know, we wouldn't close our eyes for 3 seconds while we're driving, but we'll look at our phones for 3 seconds. Distractions don't just come from inside the car. It's outside.
Yeah.
Big time. And that's why you're checking your mirrors so regularly as well. So just keeping your eyes moving so you don't get that tunnel vision.
Just before we continue with Scott's story here and what happened in the wake of the accident, what, James, would you suggest people should do if they are about to potentially run up the back of someone? And perhaps that is something that is better trained in a you know, driving solutions real world scenario. And what about someone who's in the opposite spectrum, right? Who thinks they're about to be run up the back of, can, you know, glance in their mirror and see that someone behind them is in trouble?
Yeah, I guess that what we try and go through is that if the lights have been green forever, they always seem to turn red on me when I get there. So it's using your brake. And not brake testing people, but just touching the brake. If you're coming down a hill like Scott's story was, the lights have been green forever. So just by touching the brake as you're coming towards it, just to warn the driver behind that,
in case
that might be a scenario. Yeah. And then also when you are stopped, being able to see the tyres of the car in front touching the road, so you've got room to avoid if there's another car that's not going to stop. You can take measures to minimise someone else's mistakes or minimise your own risk.
Let's go to Scott now again. And at this point, as you've heard, he's just run into the back of his mate's car. So let's find out what happens next.
I think all colour left my face immediately. I definitely swore a lot, but out of fear as well, more than anything, because firstly, I was worried that I hurt someone. Everyone in my car was fine. Everyone in my mate's car in front of me was fine as well. But then it was also the fear of what my parents would say, because this is my parents' car, our one family car, Hyundai Excel. So there was a bit of fear of, oh no, what is mum and dad going to say when I go home? And how am I going to get home? Peer pressure definitely came into it, because firstly, there's a bunch of us in our own respective cars. We're staying close to each other. You don't want other cars to come in front of you and to kind of break you up as well. So for sure, I think if it was just me in the car, even with a couple of mates in the car and there were no other vehicles that are belonging to our group, it wouldn't have happened. This was the first accident for everyone in the car. So I think everyone was surprised, shocked, and also worried. And the guy next to me, you know, he goes, oh, I remember the exact words, my neck hurts. I remember that's what he said. It was fine, but I think in the moment, and you know, that obviously concerned us, but yeah, we just didn't know what to do. The car wouldn't move. The accident was bad enough that we definitely weren't driving home in that vehicle. Neither was my mate in front of me as well. So we just got out of the car, put the hazard lights on, and just stood by, you know, on the footpath, not sure what to do in the first instance. So that probably took a few minutes. Didn't take very long, actually, for the cops to show up, and also a tow truck, as they usually do, just appeared out of nowhere. So the car in front of me, the Subaru that's built like a tank, looked completely fine, but I hit the exhaust pipe. The exhaust pipe basically went through the motor, and that car was a complete write-off. Our car looked much worse. Significant damage at the front of the vehicle, could no longer basically look out the window very clearly at the time, because it was kind of, you know, looked a bit like an old Coca-Cola can that's been crushed. So after also getting done for negligent driving by the police, which I got a ticket and yeah, fine. And I had 1 point, I think, left on my P's after that. And it was quite early on that first year that I had my P's. A mate gave me a lift home. When I got home, two of them waited for me. I still remember they were waiting with me at home. And just that night, my parents were out. So we had to wait something like an hour and a half for them to get home. I'm an only child as well. So mum and dad walk in. Mum is yelling, you know, I knew this would happen. I had a feeling this would happen. You're too young to drive. My dad, on the other hand, was very calm in the situation and said, are you okay? I said, yeah. Are your friends okay? I said, yeah. Anyone injured? No? Okay. Then who cares? It's just the car.
So Scott probably is a little like his dad here. He's spoken about this story so far, probably with the benefit of time, in a very calm fashion. But I don't want our listeners for a moment to think that that lessens the significance of this story or its severity. So firstly, highly embarrassing in front of his mates, not to mention those who may have been watching, right? The damage to the cars is huge. It didn't look like the Subaru was badly damaged, but it's a write-off. He's got upset parents. Put a little highlight underscore on the fact that if you get a negligent driving fine, that can have real long-term consequences for insurance and things like that. What stands out to me here, to both Lisa and James now, is what about other things that may have happened? Because in truth, Scott was actually quite lucky. There was no pedestrians, right? What if someone was injured or hurt? This whole scenario could have been avoided by parking the ego, using some smart distances when you're driving, and it would have been avoided for all concerned.
At the end of the day, you're travelling too close to the car in front. That's it. Bad driving. So let's not sugarcoat it with other bits as well. So, yep, peer group pressure added to it, but that's only from what he's created.
You're still responsible.
You're still responsible. Well, and you're responsible for the other two people in the car. The bit that I want to touch on as well is that his first comments that he was pale and that, you know, it's like any time you have an accident or something goes wrong, you're having a bit of an out-of-body experience. There's a lot of people out there that may have this been this scenario and they don't have the crash, but it's still important for them to pull over and get their thoughts back, not just keep driving for a secondary mistake as well. So I think sometimes we can have those close calls, but then don't make it a second accident by just driving off and thinking everything's right. Then,
phew.
Yeah. So just sometimes just calm it down. Lucky, once again, modern day cars. Like we sit there and say that his car was folded up, can't see it, but crumple zones save lives. And go back to the old 70s, you probably could have drove those cars, but people would die because of the impact and their body coming to a dead stop as well. So I think crumple zones save lives and cars are a disposable item and we should never have too much of a big thing on the car itself.
It didn't happen, but here's another possibility, right? So, James, to you, what about if it turns into a concertina? So Scott's hit his mate's car, but it can be compounded by someone else then drilling and hitting Scott's car, can't it?
Oh, without a doubt. And that's if the first mate that was driving jumped on the brakes and then he could have actually had all four of his mates crash into each other and be a massive accident. And that's where, you know, the crumple zone from behind, but he was in a small car, so there's not a lot of crumple zone in the back seat for that person that's in there as well. So it definitely comes big part of it.
It does send a reminder to us as well that modern cars, depending on the accident, obviously, can at times look like they have very little in the way of damage, as he's described here. But in fact, it can be a lot worse because they are designed to absorb a lot of this, aren't they? And to therefore protect the drivers.
Yeah. And like manufacturers spend so much time theoretically crashing cars to keep us safe inside the cockpit. And one of the other great things is even making sure that his friends all had the seatbelts on, because if they weren't wearing seatbelts, that would have been a whole different story. So I know we talk about pedestrians and animals and other things, but just making sure the people in the car are secured.
I want to move on to some reflections from Scott here on this whole thing, you know, as we near the end of this pod episode. But just before I do, James, do we need to dispel a myth here that this only happens on, you know, highways or multi-lane roads or et cetera? You know, is this a reminder about good distances no matter what the road?
Yeah, I think crashes happen everywhere. And that could be in your own street. It could be at your mate's place. I think we've always got to think we're not there till the keys are out of the car, the car's in park or in gear, handbrake on, and we're walking away from it. So I think we just need to respect it and respect speed.
Well done. And keep alert the entire journey. Let's go back to Scott. No doubt he has learned a thing or two from that day.
For sure, it's given me some type of PTSD. That was a reason why after that accident, I didn't really drive after that for a very long time. I've been nervous to actually drive on big roads, drive long distances, you know, places that I'm not very comfortable with for a very long time. And it's only kind of quite recently that I've started to drive more, go a little further out, you know, longer drives. Generally, it's been quite easy drives going into work, going to the shops, going to see the parents, that type of thing. It had a big impact on my confidence behind the wheel for sure. But it also was potentially the best thing that could have happened in a way. No one was hurt, which is the main thing. And I think it made me a more careful driver, but one that has less ego as well. I think it's difficult as well when you're young because you haven't been through anything like that. And it's very easy to feel like it won't happen to you, but it doesn't take much. It's like a split second. And if someone hurt themselves, you know, if we hit a pedestrian or if there was a death, you know, you swerve, lose control of the car, you don't know. A lot can go wrong. And I feel like there's an overconfidence, I think, of most of us behind the wheel. Like you're in this very heavy machine and you are going at high speeds and there are cars everywhere. It just takes one person to not be paying attention, one person with too much ego, one person who is reckless or has had a drink. It's like so much can go wrong. Well, now that I'm an adult, I have a child of my own, so I've had to be super careful, obviously. I think when you're alone in the car, it's one thing, but when there are the passengers in there, you're responsible for their safety as well. And I think when it's an adult, it's one thing, but when it's someone as vulnerable as like a two-year-old, you have to be so careful. You have to be so careful. And I think that's even taken how careful I am to another level as well. I think it's hard to actually know what I'm going to actually say to my son when he starts driving, considering he's only two at the moment. And I almost feel like whatever you say to your child doesn't really matter that much, because I remember back to when I was 16 or 17. I'm like, yeah, yeah, dad, okay. Yeah, yeah, I know. You're not really paying attention. I almost feel like you have to lead by example. He'll be looking at me and how I drive. Will be less around what I say and more around what I'm actually doing day to day. You know everything as a kid, of course. Absolutely. I mean, when you're growing up, there's nothing that you don't know, even though you've experienced very little.
Our producer, Todd, doesn't let us listen to these stories until we actually start recording. So that is for Lisa, James and I, the first chance to hear Scott. And we're grateful that he shared his story. I just want to reiterate something I said before. He has this kind of calmness now in his voice, but he alluded earlier on to the fact that this did have a pretty big effect on him from a PTSD standpoint, a fear perhaps of driving, a fear then of buying his own car, and natural worries about how big it could have become. In some respects, he is a little bit lucky that the incident wasn't much worse.
We talk about his effect after the accident. Maybe that's when his parents should have actually got him back in the driver's seat and actually did more driving back, like he was a learner.
Get back on the horse.
Yep, and to give him the confidence back, just driving up the road and things like that. So it's not so much teaching him how to drive again, but working together as a family to get that confidence back.
But I mean, again, it's that parental thing, and you know, and I don't mean to be, you know, bagging parents here, but they've got 20 or 30 years of bad habits. They need to get professional instructors and trainers in rather than mum and dad. Mum and dad aren't experienced, yep, or qualified to teach them how to drive, and they need to get professionals like you and James, or do it in a safe environment and let them have those mistakes, because it's the best way to learn, but you want them to have it in a safe and controlled environment.
Yeah, without a doubt. And sometimes we can say exactly the same message as the parents are saying.
But it's better from you.
Yeah. So it's understanding that whole characteristics of how they get the best out of the young drivers.
Yeah.
What kind of things would we like our younger listeners and even the parents that are working with them to walk away from this episode with about good, safe following distances?
Leave a bigger gap than you think you need to. I think that's the biggest thing. So whether it's 3 seconds, but actually keep that safe travelling distance, but also have a plan or an idea where you're going to. because we'll keep on coming back to these sort of scenarios where it's a bunch of friends, so they got to follow each other. If the fourth one doesn't know where they're going, they're going to try harder to keep up with the rest of them and drive dangerously by sitting too close. So, you know, back in the old days, we used to use maps and things like that and, you know how we're going. Where now the TomToms and things like that for young drivers, they're driving off directions all the time. So they're not driving off knowledge. They're waiting for a sat nav to tell them turn left at the next set of traffic lights. So,
yeah, in 100 metres rather than, I know I've got it. Yeah. Pre-planning.
Yeah.
So that's a really good point.
So I think it's just if we can get the fundamentals right, you know, paying attention, put the mobile phones away, be safe, have a plan of getting to your destination, we'll all be a lot safer.
And also, there's a reason why most states in Australia actually have a restriction on the amount of passengers that P-plate drivers can have. And I think for those initial, I think it's year, to only be able to have one person in the car is a great advantage to help them get more on-road experience.
It's even when you're using the person in the passenger seat as well. You know, my passenger will change the radio station. They're in control of the climate control. So just even the fundamentals of touching things while you're driving, while you're not paying attention. So I think even young drivers, if their friends are doing the music or the air conditioning, whatever it is, but just try and keep your eyes up as much as you can.
And focus 100% on the job you're doing. It is your responsibility to bring you home and also anybody else in the car.
Yep, and sadly, driving a motor vehicle is the most dangerous thing we do every day of our lives from the statistics.
Absolutely.
I think that's a perfect way to finish this episode and to encourage our listeners to get the kind of practical training that James and his team at Driving Solutions offer so that maybe it is someone else other than mum and dad really reinforcing practically what these following distances and how to do them safely is all about when you are on the road. James, thank you for joining us in the studio today and best of luck. 500 events during the year. You're a busy guy.
Look out, I'm off to one now.
There you go.
Thanks, James.
Pleasure.
On the next episode of Keep Your Wheels On, distraction while driving and how it can have devastating impacts.
I was overcorrected right into the path of an oncoming four-wheel drive. Pretty much killed the girls on impact.
We meet Kim, who lost his wife and daughters in a horrific crash, and talk about the importance of minimising distractions when behind the wheel.
It's something that's going to happen to another family maybe in the next couple of hours. Maybe now it's happening, or it's happening tomorrow.
I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is Keep Your Wheels On. Keep Your Wheels On is a listener production brought to you in partnership with My Drive School, hosted by me, Greg Rust, and Lisa Scaife. Audio production by Kelly Fulston, and executive producer is Todd Stevens.
A podcast funded by the Australian Government and supported by Repco Authorised Service.
Listener.